Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help, you save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine, which is where I work. I'm Jeet Heer, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. You can listen to this podcast on all the major platforms. This week, I want to take up what is not the familiar monster of Trump, but perhaps the more complicated monster of the sort of liberal centrists that make Trump possible. Someone who actually won a lot of support from liberal center-left and even left voters in a recent election. Earlier this spring, in April, Canada held an election, and to the relief of many on the left, not only in Canada but throughout the world, Mark Carney of the Liberal Party won. And this was seen as a kind of rebuke to Trumpism, because Carney very much ran as someone who would defend Canada against Trump. And I noticed as talking to American friends, they thought, well, this isn't all great. Now, I have to confess, I was always a kind of skeptic of Carney. And even just based on his sort of elite technocratic background. And my guest today, Luke Savage, has always also been a Carney skeptic. And I have to say, like, early days in, I think our skepticism has been warranted, that I think Carney is betraying many of the promises that he ran on. And this is something that is now being noticed, not only by critics on the left, like Luke and myself, but even some liberals. The former Liberal Foreign Affairs Minister Lloyd Axworthy used the word betrayal to describe how Carney is caving into Trump on many matters. So I guess the question we're going to address today is, you know, has Mark Carney betrayed Canada and betrayed his voters? So first of all, I want to welcome Luke Savage. He's a prolific writer for many publications, including Jacobin and the Toronto Star. And he's written recently on Carney for both the Star and the Baffler, and I'll link to those articles in the show notes. But first of all, welcome, Luke.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
So yeah, let's just start with this this question, betrayal. Like, so there were promises made, and, you know, like, I think there's good reason to think that Carney is not actually fulfilling those promises. So do you want to, like, outline what he ran on and why you and I are both, like, if not disappointed, like, pointing towards the fact that he has actually let his own voters down?
Sure. I mean, so I opened the recent piece in the Star by quoting two slogans Carney used. He made quite ample use of both of these, not only during the federal election campaign, but in his campaign for the Liberal leadership in the lead up to the federal election as well. And, you know, these are both slogans that are associated with various kinds of economic nationalism in Canada's past. And they're both slogans that I think and phrases that have a distinctly social democratic connotation because of who said them in the first place. So one of them was, Carney talked about the need for Canadians to become masters in our own home. So some of our American listeners may not, the phrase may not scan, but this was used by the Quebec Liberal Party in the 1960s by figures like Jean Lesage, the premier of Quebec, during what's known as the Quiet Revolution, which was a period in which Quebec rapidly modernized itself. It built up a huge public sector. This specific phrase, masters in our own home, was used during, I believe it was the 1962 provincial campaign, where, you know, government was seeking re-election And one of their big campaign promises was the nationalization of hydroelectricity. So, you know, if the slogan, if Masters in Our Own Home suggests anything, we're talking about, you know, nationalization of industry. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the building of a welfare state, the building of the public sector in Quebec and that sort of thing. The second phrase.
I should also add in the Quebec context, because Quebec was basically a colony within Canada with like a kind of Anglo elite that did not represent the people. It was a slogan of decolonization. It was like, yes. You know, like in keeping with the spirit of the 1960s, it was like the idea that, you know, like this nation will not be governed by foreign capital, but will take command of its own destiny.
Yes, thank you. That's exactly right. And not just English Canadian capital, but American corporations, yes, operating in Quebec as well. So yeah, it's a very potent, the phrase is quite a loaded one. And the mm-hmm. second one was used by my late friend Ed Broadbent when he was the leader of the NDP, Canada's Social Democratic Party, in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, as far as I can tell, Carney was kind of lifting the phrase directly from Ed when he talked about the need for Canada to take control of its economic destiny. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, this when Ed Broadbent said it, he was talking about the need for an industrial strategy in Canada. You know, Ed Broadbent was someone who championed public ownership over certain natural resources. You know, in the early 70s, helped spearhead the partial nationalization of the petroleum sector, that kind of thing. So, you know, whatever people heard in these slogans, and obviously political slogans are, I mean, they're slogans. They are designed, especially when someone like Mark Carney uses them. You know, you're meant to project into them somewhat, but whatever people heard, you know, whether they recognized the specific, you know, historical reference points or not, I don't think they heard, you know, a neoliberal agenda of cuts. You know, I don't think they heard, and I think this is the other sort of the other thrust of my recent piece in the Star, the policy of kind of cajolery towards Donald Trump. You know, this was really the other plank of the Carney campaign that I think really resonated with people, was the idea that we're going to have this very competent, calm, managerial figure who's really going to stand up to Donald Trump and is going to pursue a new kind of economic nationalism, a new kind of nation building project in Canada, to respond to the fact that the trade relationship and the diplomatic relationship that Canada has enjoyed with the United States is in the process of collapsing. Now, you asked about betrayal, and I do think that's how many people will feel. I don't feel betrayed exactly, because I didn't, you know, I've been a skeptic of Carney from the very beginning. He's always seemed like a technocrat to me. But I have been very surprised by, I guess, how abruptly the government appears to have pivoted. And I think that, you know, the Liberal campaign itself at the level of detail was often quite nonspecific about what exactly it was going to do. I think, you know, I get into this in the piece a bit, but there was, you know, kind of simultaneously a language of nation building that you heard, you know, strengthening national institutions and so on. But you also heard the language of kind of budgetary discipline, fiscal discipline, that kind of thing. So there was always a bit of a slipperiness in the things Carney was saying. And you know, my experience writing about Liberal politicians is, if, you know, unless they're being very, very specific, or centrist Liberal politicians, I should say, unless they're being very specific about what it is they're proposing to do or what they believe, you know, the blank space in the things they say is often a conservative space. You know, that's the things left unsaid or, you know, that's often the conservative direction they intend to go in. So betrayal isn't how I feel exactly, but myself, but I think many people probably voted. I think when many people voted Liberal after hearing we're going to become masters in our own home, they didn't, you know, they weren't anticipating the direction the government now seems to be taking.
Well, I mean, I in the last election, I mean, one thing that happened was that there was a collapse of the Social Democratic Party, the NDP, which had one of its, I think, its worst showing in history. And I know from going to events that there were a lot of people who were like, you know, diehard NDP voters who had always voted for NDP and who voted for Carney, partially because there's a sense of emergency. We have to have someone to stand up to Trump. And but also, you know, thinking that this guy will do the job that one would expect center left politician of doing of nation building. And to maybe zero in on a specific thing, like maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I actually specifically remember, like, before the election, Carney was talking about like giving like sustained dedicated funding to rebuilding the CBC. That's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, our national broadcasting company, which has suffered from a long period of cuts from both liberal and conservative governments. I mean, that seemed like a very specific thing that he said. And now he's going to, looks like he's doing the opposite, right? Like, am I wrong about that?
Yeah, so during the campaign, they pledged $150 million to boost the CBC, you know, which is a significant amount of money. I think it is, it's less than what the outgoing Minister of Heritage or the former Minister of Heritage suggested. I think her figure was $200 million. And the reason she was suggesting that amount is because it could potentially allow the CBC to go ad-free. Nonetheless, $150 million is a considerable investment. And don't quote me on this because I haven't had my head in it since I wrote the piece. But when last I checked, the government's line on this was that they're still planning to make the investment, but because they've also asked the CBC to find $198 million in cuts over the next 3 years. I mean, that they'll be looking at a net cut of something like $50 million. So,
yeah,
it's like you can pump $150 million in, but if you're taking a larger number out, I'm not sure that constitutes an investment.
No. I mean, yeah. It's clearly a shell game. And like, you know, like, let's spell it out. Like, I think that the broader thrust of his policy is towards making sort of cuts on social spending, domestic spending, while bolstering military spending, and I think police, you know, sort of border control stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in my piece, I go into this in more detail, but, you know, there's going to be a budget later this year, probably in the fall. And ahead of that budget, it seems that much of the public sector, every single ministry, almost every single ministry in the federal government, every department has been asked to find ambitious savings, which, you know, means cuts of up to 15% over the next 3 years. Some places have been, asked to find greater cuts. This extends not just to government departments, but also to places like the National Research Council, Statistics Canada, the Canadian Museum of Human Rights, important institutions in Canadian civil society. And as you alluded to already, Jeet, other places have been asked to find much lower, you know, they've been given much lower targets. So Department of National Defense, the RCMP, Border Services, etc. And I mean, one does have to speak a little bit tentatively here because we haven't seen the budget yet. I had one source tell me or suggest that specific cuts that may have been demanded or that are being demanded by to the CBC are in fact a bit of a feint, and they're actually still are planning to go and invest in the CBC. I mean, we'll have to see, but I don't see a scenario where the finance minister sends letters to every other member of cabinet and says, find 15% savings ahead of next fall's budget, and that isn't a prelude to cuts. And just to underscore the point, if cuts were made on this scale, so if there were, you know, 15% cuts basically across the board in government departments, there's a study by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, which suggests that we'd be looking at as many as 57,000 full-time civil servants losing their jobs. So these would be absolutely lacerating cuts. Just the Ottawa-Gatineau region alone, so Canada's capital region, something like 23,000 to 25,000 jobs would be lost just in that area. And it's important to note here that, I mean, this would be an explicitly broken Liberal campaign promise, because while Mark Carney did talk about capping the size of the public sector, there was no sense that he didn't say anything about firing people. So this would be quite an explicit betrayal, if that's the right word. And I guess just one more point to make here, which I guess I kind of hinted at already, the specific language Carney uses around spending and investment and fiscal discipline is, it's worth putting on record here, because I suspect this is a trick that we're going to see others borrow. It's because I think it proved quite effective during the campaign. Since Carney ran for the Liberal leadership, or as soon as he ran for the Liberal leadership, he started talking about this way of bifurcating the federal government's budgeting process, such that there'd be kind of two budgets, or, you know, there'd be an operational budget and a capital budget, which, as he says, you know, this allows the government to spend and do nation building, but maintain, you know, fiscal discipline while it invests. And what this really seems to be describing is a situation where, you know, the government cuts a lot of, there's a lot of cuts to the public sector, but these are sort of labeled as investments, because then the savings from that are partly redirected into this capital budget, and they are used to, in Carney's, well, his one of his favorite kind of technocrat phrases, to catalyze private sector investment. So we'd be talking about a sort of massive public-private partnership here. And it's kind of ingenious when you think about it, because it really does seem to be a way that you can make potentially quite lacerating cuts and call it nation building and say you're actually doing investments. You know, you're simply redeploying assets. It's not austerity.
Yeah. No. You're redeploying assets, but also, you know, basically creating an enhanced system of sort of, you know, corporate government cooperation, right? Like that sort of, you know, it is a kind of like state capitalism model. But one where, like, you know, the capitalist will keep getting all the profits, you know, like it seems that highly dubious in many ways. So this austerity stuff, like, you know, does seem like, you know, the opposite of any sort of nation building that, you know, has kind of happened before, that is, you know, really going to push Canada in a much further along a neoliberal line. And the other aspect is the sort of relationship with the United States, where, again, like, I do think, you know, like, people came to Carney with a sense of, you know, like, here's a guy who will stand up to the United States. And Trump was the major election issue in the Canadian election. I mean, I think, you know, for the past 2 years, the Conservatives were on track to win, like, actually a very strong majority. And the reason that they fell behind was that the Liberals were seen as, you know, more willing to stand up to Trump. So how is that going?
I mean, here, I mean, it's arguably worse. And I mean, here, I think I'm in some ways more surprised by the posture the government's assumed here, because I think that, you know, it was so obvious that their election victory was heavily about a deep feeling throughout much of the electorate, including, I think, among many people who are at least potential conservative voters. You know, the deep feeling that the country is being threatened by the United States and by Donald Trump specifically, and we need to stand up to that. And what we've seen instead is that the government is considering signing on to Trump's proposed his multi-billion dollar Golden Dome missile defense initiative. You know, they're considering it, at least. They're currently pushing a border bill, you know, which has been widely criticized by civil liberties groups like the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Amnesty International has denounced it as an attack on the rights of those seeking asylum. And, you know, this is all, it would seem, to humor, you know, the ludicrous assertion Trump has periodically made that the reason he's doing tariffs, and obviously we know the justification for the tariffs and the trade stuff constantly changes, but one of the justifications is that, you know, drugs are coming in to the United States, fentanyl is coming in from Canada, that kind of thing. And our government's response is to, you know, shovel billions of dollars to border services and to, you know, pass this heavy-handed border bill. There have been other things as well. The government had a digital services tax plan, which would have been paid by companies like Netflix and Google. It dropped that at the last minute on Trump's request, I think just a few hours before it was going to go into effect. And the White House was quite explicit on that. They said, oh yeah, you know, Carney capitulated, Canada capitulated. So, you know, it goes on and on. I mean, I think, you know, in the realm of foreign policy, we've seen these little experiments, I suppose. I was on a panel a month or so ago on the agenda on TV Ontario, discussing the joint statement released by Mark Carney, Keir Starmer, and Macron, which you know was kind of taking a different line, at least rhetorically speaking, on Israel and Gaza than the Trump administration was taking. And you know, there was kind of wider conversation between that and we haven't talked about this, but Mark Carney inviting the king to come and deliver the government's throne speech a few months ago. And so, you know, there's been a sort of I guess there's been some trial balloons about, you know, maybe Canada should act more independently from the United States by, I guess, in a sense, retrenching to, you know, the empire that it used to have a special relationship with. I'm very skeptical of that for various reasons we don't need to get into. But to me, these have been kind of the exception. I think the line the government has tended to take in so many places, and even on foreign policy as well, is if it's different from the Trump administration, this is particularly true on Gaza, I think it is, it's largely just they're telling a different story. They're saying things that, you know, the rhetoric is different, but the policy isn't necessarily changing. Canada, according to a recent report, Canada's still exporting arms to the Israelis. You know, this is, and there's been this, announcement, which, you know, has driven the Trump administration mad, obviously driven Netanyahu mad about, you know, Canada, France, and Britain are going to recognize a Palestinian state in September, which is a very different line than the one the Trump administration has taken, except that when you actually look into the details, it's very clear that in many ways, they're just sort of reiterating the same position that these governments have had all along. You know, this would be there's so many conditions attached to it that it's not actually recognition of a Palestinian state. And so again, here, I think I bring it up just in part to underscore that often the differences, the daylight between Canada's new government and Donald Trump, if it exists at all, is often, you know, in foreign policy terms, is often, it's kind of just rhetorical. There's not the kind of, you know, independent, muscular foreign policy that I think a lot of people were hoping to see.
No, I absolutely not. I mean, it does seem like more a difference in rhetoric rather than in reality. And I mean, to draw maybe a historical contrast, you know, like, in some ways, Canada was very complicit in the Vietnam War, just as we are in the war with Gaza. But Pierre Trudeau was like much more critical of the Vietnam policy than like Carney has been of what Israel is doing. Trudeau and his predecessor, Lester Pearson, as he made, you know, very significant overtures that went against American desires in terms of an opening towards China, dealings with Cuba. And this was not just true of liberal governments. In the 1980s, you're a policy nerd, so maybe you'll know the answer to this, but do you know which was the government that Canada gave the most foreign policy aid to under Brian Mulroney, the Conservative Prime Minister, in the 1980s?
That's a good question. Was it in somewhere in Latin America?
It was somewhere in Latin America.
Okay, are you going to tell me?
It was Nicaragua.
Nicaragua.
It was Nicaragua. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was the largest recipient of Canadian foreign aid in the Americas and on South Africa as well. I mean, one could say Mulroney never did enough, but I mean, he actually spoke against apartheid at that period where Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were very much not inclined to do so. So yeah, I mean, I think that Carney's willingness to challenge the American empire under Trump is significantly less than Canadian prime ministers in, you know, the recent past. I think it's actually worth pulling back a little bit because, you know, with the Trump winning like a second time, I had the thought and other people had the thought that, you know, this would be a period for the NATO countries to actually like rethink their foreign policy. Like, can you really, you know, like have a foreign policy that's so reliant on the United States if it is willing to elect someone who basically sees the alliance system as a protection racket, who, you know, wants to use it to sell American weapons, but is otherwise like very unreliable and very mercurial and destabilizing of, you know, your fundamental trade relationships and policy relationships. And, you know, one has seen, like in some places, I think particularly France, you know, discussion of like, what would an independent foreign policy look like? But the larger actual action of European leaders, and I think Carney is part of this, has been like to double down on being vassals of the American Empire, to try to develop a strategy of, let's, you know, try to give Trump a lot of what he wants. Let's give him the military spending he wants, which, you know, like all these promises of 5% spending on the military, like that is actually a protection racket. It is saying we will buy American weapons. And this is a way for America to like make a profit from its empire. And combined with a sort of policy of flattery, of, you know, like of sort of praising Trump. Now, I really have to like question, you know, like what it does sort of show a sort of timidity and unwillingness to think about alternatives. And also, like, does this policy of flattery actually work with someone who is basically, you know, like running the country like a mob boss and always wants more and more? I think the recent example of India perhaps points to an answer to this question, because Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, you know, very much followed this path of flattery, of saying Trump is his great friend, of campaigning for Trump in 2019. And now Trump just slapped India with, like, you know, massive 50% tariffs, because he didn't think that India went far enough. He didn't think that India was praising Trump as he wanted to for supposedly helping a ceasefire, which the Indian government denies, between India and Pakistan. So, yeah, I mean, it's like, why do you think that these policy elites are so committed to a sort of status quo policy of flattering Trump and giving him a lot of what he wants and thinking that this is the way to solve their problem with the United States?
You know, this is something that I would read with great interest, a really deep dive into. You know, I would love somebody to really explore this carefully in a long read of some kind, because I can only offer kind of some speculation here. And I think that the general phenomenon is, as you're describing it, is exactly right. And I also think when it comes to Canada, when it comes to the Europeans, probably when it comes to you know, other countries as well, we've seen just in the past few months, really, just since the start of the year, I mean, there was a more there was a harder line being taken on Trump by lots of countries, including by Canada. We were doing big retaliatory tariffs. There were, you know, U.S. liquor was getting pulled off the shelves, that kind of thing. You know, there was a province of Ontario where I live was threatening to shut off the lights in upstate New York, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, struggling to think of specific examples, but, you know, I think that the Europeans were kind of adopting a similar posture. And that all seems to have kind of evaporated in the last few months. And I know of no way to explain this other than, as I think you said already, there is a class of political elites in place who really just are unable or unwilling to think about what a future in which the United States is not sort of the anchor of the international order to which they subscribe. They're not able to think in those terms. So really they're hoping they can ride this out and kind of offer Trump things in piecemeal, and that, you know, perhaps after a year, after 2 years, he'll get bored. Maybe, you know, the Democrats will win the midterms. Trump will kind of be a lame duck president. But, you know, it seemed there was an opportunity earlier in the year for a really, you know, coordinated global response of some kind that would compel even the United States to back off. And I mean, it should be said that when Canada, you know, in Canada's case, when we retaliated Trump's tariffs, the effect was often that he would postpone his own tariffs. Mm-hmm. So pressure does work. And I've seen really no evidence to date that this kind of strategy of cajolery, you know, that this works. And I don't know why anybody would think it would. I mean, granted, it would be difficult for anyone, any government, any country, regardless of size, to deal with Trump, you know, particularly when it comes to trade, because, you know, as I said, I mean, the justification for Trump's, you know, for Trumponomics is constantly changing, right? Sometimes it's to generate new revenue for the U.S. federal government so that the U.S. doesn't have to charge income tax. Sometimes it's because drugs are coming over the border from Canada and Mexico. Sometimes it's, you know, when Trump announced the sort of, what did he call it? Liberation Day, VE Day, the sort of global tariffs day with those big charts. You know, this is being announced as this is that we're, you know, this is heralding a new global economic order. And then, you know, within a few days or a few weeks, now this is a negotiating tactic, and it's about, you know, getting good deals. So how exactly one should respond to this is very much an open question. Reasonable people can disagree. I think it's very clear, though, that countries dealing with the United States in this situation, dealing with the Trump administration on a purely bilateral basis and hoping that because of their specific economic advantages, their resource base, whatever it is, they can sort of just get a better deal out of the Trump administration than other countries, or a slightly less bad deal. I think this is a losing strategy, and it applies to trade, it applies to foreign policy, it applies to everything.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think partially it is the feeling that Trump was backing down. I mean, the sort of, you know, rhetoric of tackle, that like the really massive tariffs that he promised, he did back down. And the sort of, I mean, I think it's a way a lot of the business class in Wall Street also feel, that he'll have some tariffs, but it won't fundamentally change things and will be a temporary thing. I should also add to the rationale of Trump doing tariffs, I mean, another thing is just to help particular American corporations such as Elon Musk or Silicon Valley, you know, get deregulation in foreign countries. But I mean, like, an alternative to American, like, you know, being the anchor of global capitalism would be like trying to create an alternative structure. It would mean that Canada and the Europeans would have to start negotiating with China, Brazil, India, and try to create a different structure for trade that is a counterpart to the US and can, like, you know, sort of challenge the United States when an American president runs havoc the way Trump has been doing. But I just don't think, like, the weak spot of this, that alternative, is the Western elites. I think Western elites are still, like, fundamentally committed to a NATO worldview. And as long as they have that, then their ability to challenge Trump is very much blunted. But I'd be curious about your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really improve on that, except to say, I mean, there's a bit of a parallel here in terms of, you know, a situation that just makes you kind of shrug your shoulders in frustration, or more than shrug your shoulders. But it is, yeah, I mean, it's so obvious that this strategy, this tack they're taking with the trade war isn't working. But you might say the same thing about the way Western elites have responded to the situation in Gaza, right? I mean,
yeah,
these are elites who have functioned in a system which, since 1945, has premised, you know, the whole legitimacy of Western countries to act in the world is premised on ostensibly certain principles of human rights and certain rules about how countries are allowed to behave. And we've seen that, you know, over the past few years, we've seen that playbook thrown out entirely. There's always been many asterisks attached to those rules when it comes to the Palestinians. But I mean, we've seen that playbook go out the window entirely. And, you know, again, I mean, there's various ways you could explain that. But it does speak to, I think, on this and on Trump and on so much else, just a total sclerosis among Western elites, a total inability to break from the status quo, to break from certain learned habits, certain reflexes, and really, you know, just a deep ideological investment in the so-called rules-based international order as they understand it, which, you know, the United States is kind of the linchpin of. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's many things over the past few years that I thought, at least for a time, might lead to some kind of a crack up, a kind of some cracks in that, or ruptures in that consensus. And it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, no. And if one thinks of, you know, the issue as being this kind of, you know, post-war elite that is unwilling to confront, you know, the new world and, you know, changes that are happening and the sort of lawlessness, you know, right-wing lawlessness within their own system, then I think Carney actually becomes a significant global figure. Because, I mean, one of the interesting things about him is that he is kind of centrist liberal response to this age of anti-system politics that, you know, doesn't try to rhetorically co-opt populism in any way. Like, it does not, you know, like, usually you see politicians, even from very elite backgrounds, and, you know, Trump himself is an example of this, but it is very common that people from elite backgrounds will pretend to be mavericks, outsiders, challenging the system. And I think in your Baffler piece, you bring out this very well. Like, Carney is like, you know, he's of the elite and he's proud of it, right? Like, doesn't he actually say, like, I'm elitist and a globalist?
Yeah. I mean, this he said, the context is funny too, because he said, the quote was, people will say I'm an elitist or a globalist. Well, that's exactly what we need. And he was on a podcast that, I gather is hosted by, I mean, you can watch the clip. It's, he's talking to Anthony Scaramucci and, Alistair Campbell, the former Tony Blair strategist. So, strong nominee for the world's worst podcast, I think, by the way. But no, Carney leaned right into this, right into this kind of elitist image. He leaned right into his background as governor of two G7 central banks and Goldman Sachs before that, and this kind of a giant asset management company that he was recently working at. You know, he was doing ESG work and that sort of thing there, climate activism, at least of the corporate kind. I mean, it's worth saying he did periodically kind of try to brand himself as an outsider during the liberal leadership race anyway, because he hadn't held elected office. But, you know, you can't really be an outsider, and no one thinks you are, if your last title was vice chairman and head of impact investing at a global financial firm with a trillion in assets, right? It's not very convincing.
Yeah, no. If you run two central banks, you're not an outsider, by definition.
In Carney's book, the acknowledgments are fun, because it's like, it's this who's who of, it's page after page of Michael Bloomberg and Bill Gates and people like that. It's the cream of sort of the Davos jet set. But yeah, Carney has basically leaned into this, more so than really any other. I can't think of an equivalent figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you compare him to somebody like Macron, right? Another sort of would-be centrist savior figure. You know, Macron, he still tried to embrace this kind of rhetoric of transformation. You know, we're going beyond left and right. You know, we have a radical new synthesis we're doing. And I'm going to be this Jupiterian figure who's kind of like stands atop, the elites and kind of operates over their heads and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's just one example. But yeah, Carney has not tried to do that at all. He's explicitly presented himself as a managerial figure, and I think that probably would not have worked well for him in really any other context. I think the stars were aligned earlier this year for him everything was perfectly lined up for somebody running with his message, a person with his instincts and his pedigree and his credentials to have political appeal. And I think I have my hunches that Carney's political judgment in a lot of places is actually not that strong. Yeah. But I think one possible counterexample or contrary piece of evidence is the fact that there have been rumors about him wanting to enter politics for at least a decade. And he did, he waited quite patiently for the perfect moment in which he could have the easiest and the fastest and most frictionless ascent to the prime minister's office. And that's what he's and that's what he did.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is a very odd thing that he found the perfect moment, perhaps the only moment where someone like him could win in a national election. And, you know, like, we're getting near the end of this, but I want to suggest that there is a kind of cultural component to this, which you gestured towards when you said, you know, he wanted to, you know, bring King Charles into Canada. And he often talks about Canada being the most European nation in North America. A friend of mine who does sort of cultural studies points out that there's apparently a lot of YouTube and Instagram and TikTok videos that are kind of like thirst trap videos for Carney, where he's presented as the kind of, you know, like daddy figure. And so there is something like this kind of like, in a moment of crisis where people are turning towards, you know, that sort of 1950s technocratic father knows best, the kind of, you know, NASA astronaut or engineer who can, like, you know, has know-how and can solve problems, right? Like there's maybe something in the zeitgeist that made this baffling figure possible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to some extent, this is partly just the clickbait economy and the sort of cringe content it gives us. I mean, I remember last summer after the British election, people tried to get Hot Keir Summer going. I don't think that one really caught on, and I suspect the Carney equivalent will be kind of transitory too. But I do think all of this speaks to something we haven't really talked about that's an important factor in all of this. I mean, something that I've felt again and again that I found very frustrating throughout the whole time I've been writing about politics is that periods of crisis, I think, often breed a kind of they often encourage a kind of small C conservatism in electorates. And by that, I mean, you know, oftentimes in particularly a moment like this one, you know, Trump 2.0, you might intuitively think that this would breed a kind of more radical politics. There would be a greater receptiveness to, you know, breaking with the status quo, breaking with consensus. And, you know, to some extent, that's true. But I think by and large, in the political mainstream anyway, that's not what we tend to see. And what we've seen again here is that instead, anti-politics become quite appealing, right? People are, and you know, I'm sympathetic here to a certain extent, right? People are sick of turning on the news and seeing things that are upsetting and disturbing. And, you know, if you're a Canadian, being threatened with annexation by the President of the United States would certainly fall under that aegis. So in that context, I think technocratic politics like those championed by a figure like Carney, there's an obvious appeal to them, because what you're really saying is let's elect, the nice daddy banker, and he's just going to make politics go away. You know, we don't have to think about this now. He's going to go away and he's going to, I don't know, bring out his spreadsheets, and he's going to call up his friends at Davos, and he's going to use his Rolodex to talk to world leaders and get us the good deals and whatever. I mean, it's and we're not going to have to think about it. And right now in Canada, you know, the government's approval rating is still very high. Carney's own approval ratings are very high. I don't think the more conservative direction it appears to be taking, I don't think that's really kicked in. And it'll be interesting to see how people respond in the fall when there's a budget. But for now, I think that there's a bit of a period of kind of national denial going on, because, you know, so often, and I think this is something that, you know, American listeners can fully appreciate for their own reasons. You know, when you're dealing with a figure like Donald Trump and the news cycles he gives rise to, there is an obvious appeal to just, being just like, make it go away. I don't want to have to think about this, right? I want to see less anxious things on TV or when I read the paper. And I think that's very much where we're at in Canada right now with Mark Carney.
Yeah, no, I think I'm glad you brought up that, because and I'll maybe end on that note. There's this kind of vicious cycle where the threatening figures of the anti-system right give rise to people seeking safety and centrism, thinking that this will return to normal. But then the inability of those centrists to like deal with problems then feeds more right-wing anger. And I think one saw that with Trump's first term leading the Democrats to pick the oldest and most centrist and most representative figure of the old order that they could possibly find, the half-dead Joe Biden, and that this did not work out well because that sort of politics. So, you know, maybe it gives you a period where you don't have to pay attention to the news, you can go to brunch, but it doesn't like address the fundamental problems. And then it leaves the right to sort of harvest the anger that exists because of the existing system, and it leads to like further problems. So I think that the current honeymoon that, you know, Mark Carney is enjoying, I do not think that this will be long lived. And I think that your articles, which again I'll link to and which I recommend people read, you know, point towards, I think, what we're going to see in a year or 2 years from now, which is that this project of ancien regime restoration is not going to play out very well, and it's going to lead us to like a very dangerous place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And on that note of comedy, I will thank Luke once again, and it's been great talking to you.
Cheers.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.